All right, welcome back to Anger, Sadness, and Envy, the Rampancy.net podcast. My name is Narcogen. I'm the webmaster of Bungie fansite, Rampancy.net, and I'm joined here by Blackstar of Blackstar Productions.
Hey, how's it going?
And Cody Miller of High Speed Halo. And we're here to talk about the first level of the latest Halo game by Bungie, and we're expecting it to be the last Halo game by Bungie, Halo Reach. It's the level Winter Contingency. And we're going to do a little bit of a format change for this episode, try to kind of keep things moving. We're going to give every contributor a chance to say a few words about a given topic, and then we're going to move right on and kind of stop our meandering about here. So getting right into the level here, we talked a lot about ODST in our last series of podcasts. We talked about how ODST was the first Halo game that started with a text crawl. This one is the only Halo game that starts with a flashback. You get a look at your own helmet on the burning, charred surface of Reach Post Invasion, and then they transition right to a shot where you're putting that same helmet on inside the Warthog while you're going off to meet Noble Team. And, of course, if you've customized your helmet, those customizations show in the two scenes so that you can clearly see that that's the player's helmet, that this is the helmet of Noble Six. Starting with Blackstar, what do you guys think about this technique? Does this work? Does this achieve the thing that Bungie wants in setting you up with your character?
Well, to quote Fight Club, flashback humor. Basically, I think it's an interesting technique. It's definitely a device that they want to bring in people who have probably never, ever played a Halo game before into something to say, hey, we know this is going to really suck, but we want you to understand that it's for a good cause. It's I would say a minor to moderate plot device that's been used many, many times before. But as far as anything terribly dramatic or groundbreaking or new or incidental, I don't really think it's that big of a deal. As far as the different elements that they used before in the beginnings of all their other games, yeah, the text crawl, they had to, I guess. There was so much going on, and ODST was such a halfway add-on to Halo 3 that they didn't really have a choice. You know, there was no real way to do it in the concise short amount of time to get you up to speed and to going to have at least an inkling. But there is such a wide populace of Halo players, unfortunately, that literally don't follow or care about the storyline at all, which personally I'm quite the opposite. So for them, I don't think it would really matter either way because they're really interested in the multiplayer aspect, and the advances and the changes in that are what captures their interest, not what interesting plot or story devices that Bungie decides to use in the introduction of the games.
Okay. Cody, first, stop making that noise. And second, what do you think about the flashback opening of Halo Reach?
Well, isn't it a flash forward?
But you could view it that the entire game after that point is a flashback.
Okay, I suppose. But I don't think it's that effective, just because, typically when you'd want to do something like that, have a flash forward at the beginning of the film, of a film, let's talk about film. it's because, you want the audience to know that the character is going to be in this, perilous situation at some point in the future. And hopefully that's going to, there's going to be tension there because you're going to wonder like, oh my gosh, how are they going to get there? And then when they get there, how are they going to get out of there? But it doesn't work for Reach because even without that, you know what's going to happen. I mean, you know that Reach is destroyed and everybody's killed. So it doesn't really do anything. It doesn't really add anything when you already know what's going to happen. And then I think the second part of why it's not that effective is it's kind of a lie, because if you sit around for the end, you realize that, well, the planet wasn't actually glassed and, they're rebuilding themselves there. So it's a little bit of a fake out, and it kind of I kind of felt cheated.
Well, the point here is not that the planet is dead. The point here is that you are dead. However, I agree with Cody. This does not work terribly well. They've already underscored the fact that, from the end, the beginning. And the other problem I have with this technique is that the only reason you know whose helmet that is at the beginning is because you've customized it. This flash forward technique only works, really, the first time you play the game. And the first time you play the game, you're probably playing with the default helmet. So it doesn't work until your second playthrough or until you've customized, at which point you already know what's going to happen. So they might as well not have done it.
Well, I've never customized my helmet, and I understood that it was my helmet. Yeah.
You're riding with me, Noble Six.
Not gonna lie to you, Lieutenant. You're stepping into some shoes the rest of the squad would rather leave unfilled. Me, I'm just happy to have Noble back up to full strength. Just one thing, I've seen your file, even the parts the Oni sensors didn't want me to. I'm glad to have your skill set. But we're a team. That lone wolf stuff stays behind. Clear? Got it, sir.
Hungry like the lone wolf. Does the foreshadowing of Carter's line that the lone stuff stays behind. And of course, you do end the game in a level called Lone Wolf where you're all by yourself. Spoilers, everybody. Does that work as well when part of the game's marketing campaign was from the end, you know, the beginning? Blackstar.
Are we talking about just the actual last episode that you're playing here, or
no, we're talking about the opening cutscene where Carter says that lone stuff stays behind. I mean, does that line make you groan like this cave is not a natural formation, or do you think that's a way to shadow the way this game ends?
If we're going to focus how the opening dialogue with Carter is, I thought that whole opening section there from when Noble Six walks in and gets the introduction and Kat kind of holds him back with her fake arm. Obvious plot point. I was waiting for somebody at the end of it to pop out from the side and say, everybody got that? The dialogue, was a bit cringeworthy. And I won't say it's going to be as famous as the Cortana line about this is not a natural formation. I think actually Carter's line that would be of the same caliber was, the Spartans never die, they're just missing in action. I thought that was absolutely facepalm worthy, and really surprised that they let something like that through. But the lone wolf, I guess they wanted it as a, you know, either dramatic foreshadowing or a thread that they wanted to lay at your feet to say that this is what this character is about, and it is going to become important at some point. And you do kind of get the inkling that this is going to be the last player that you're working on anyway. So as far as it working in that aspect, I can see why they kept it in, but as far as it meaning anything beyond that, no, I thought it was kind of subtle.
Okay, Cody.
I didn't really enjoy the opening, you know, in part because, yeah, I mean, particularly, I guess if we look at that line, it's just, you know, it's obvious that Bungie is just trying to cram it down your throat through writing, you know, just to say, hey, you have to, you know, you have to support your team. It's about the noble team. You got to stick together. You know, it's just like that entire opening is beating that into your head. Whereas I think if they had written it better, or if it was told better, then that kind of thing would like unfold naturally through, you know, say the interactions between the characters, rather than just having basically Carter tell us what is going to have to happen throughout the rest of this game.
Well, I think we've nailed that right on the head. This is an exposition dump with actually very little exposition in it. And the point it makes, as you said, that you need to support your team, actually is worked against by the entire rest of the game, as it often makes sense from a gameplay perspective to completely ignore your teammates.
Yep, as usual.
Okay, next topic. So much so fast, it's glorious. I'm wondering, looking at this same scene, are they introducing too many characters too quickly? In Halo 1, early in the game, you get your own character, the Chief, you meet Cortana and Captain Keyes, and then you get a cameo by the as-yet-unnamed Sniper Sergeant, who becomes Sergeant Johnson. And then there are no other characters of consequence introduced until 343 Guilty Spark comes into the game several levels later. Here, within a few minutes, we have to be introduced to Noble Six, as well as Carter, Kat, June, Emil, and George. And then we get an exposition dump about the insurrection that is familiar only to people who've read the novels and nobody else. And that makes no sense within the context of a 40-year Human Covenant war, to say nothing of the expanding conflict between the three main sequence games among the Human, the Covenant, and the Flood. Did Bungie overthink this scene? Cody?
They certainly overwrote it. I don't know if they overthought it. Because, well, you know, in particular with the insurrection, I mean, you know, when you make a game, you have to kind of come at it thinking that not everybody is going to have read the novels, right? So, you can't just assume that they have. And I think that if, you know, I mean, I have read them, but I'm thinking if I hadn't read them, I still kind of understand what's going on. So I guess it did its job there. But it's just, I don't really think it's too much information. I just think that it wasn't presented in a way that was interesting. In terms of how many characters there are, that's not really, I don't really think that's too many characters to keep track of. It's just that once you introduce them, then, you know, down the line after that, that's when you start to get to know them. And that's kind of when I think things started going bad, because we don't really get to know the characters.
Okay, Black Star.
I think the biggest impact for that, it is one thing to be introduced to the characters. It's another one to digest them as something other than devices or the mindless bots that you've seen in all the other games, where you get their voices in random dialogue segments that come out at interesting times during combat situations. But they're not really defined characters, whereas in this one, they're very much supposed to be important to the extension of not only the story, but also the plot. And getting the introduction the way that you did is basically a, hi, these are the following people, you know, everybody remember their names, so you don't actually shoot them in the ass when you're hiding behind rocks, is one thing. And as far as how they did it, you know, you didn't get that same kind of military feel, I think, where other characters are simply, you know, brought together and say, hi, this is the people and here we're going on a mission. So there's not a lot of time for the, you know, hey, let's get to know you type stuff. You learn about them, like you said, in the combat situations within the confines of the story in the game.
Well, I was going to say the one that they do well is Jorge, because he, you know, during that first interaction, he kind of calms down the civilian to try to say, hey, you know, what's going on? And then, you know, when the girl loses her father, he sort of comforts her. I mean, like, that, those are good moments. And, like, they sort of, you know, you get to know this guy and you sort of understand how he thinks and, you know, how he deeply cares about this planet. And it's just a shame that they didn't do something like that for all the other characters.
Right. And that's the point I was making, is that you only really get a chance to see and get a feel for each one of them in those expose moments or in those non-combat moments, or the cutscenes where you actually have some type of interactivity between other characters. The way that, you know, Kat, you know, talks to the leader there, what's his face? And the few moments where you're actually talking with everyone else, where George feels that he has to sacrifice himself to save Reach. Those little moments, you get an individual slice of those characters. And especially at the end, spoilers coming up, with talking to the doctor when they're heading down over to, you know, one of the last levels.
Halsey?
Yeah, they're all interacting with her in a much different way than you've seen them before. So their relationship with her comes out in little slices with that. But it's never a big chunk. You get little snippets all throughout the game. And I think Bungie did want to stretch that out, so you got a chance to feel how the characters change and interact as their numbers slowly dwindle down. But as far as how the introduction was done or whether they thought too much about it or anything like that, I really, really can't say either way. It just didn't seem that big an element to it. It seemed to almost take a sidecar to what you were interested in, which was what was going on with Reach. Where are we going and what's going on and how is that you know, progressing the plot and the story? I was far more interested in what was going on with that than whether or not, you know, June liked Emil or Emil liked Kat or Carter liked June or whatever. So as far as that goes and how they related to the combat of what was going on was far more interesting to me.
Okay. Cody is right. Bungie did overwrite that scene. But I also want to go a step further and say that I don't think the insurrection as a plot device worked at all. You're right that people don't know that if they haven't read the novels, and they should write this game for people who haven't necessarily read the novels. But there's no point in using this except as a misdirection device. But everybody knows that this game is about the Covenant invading Reach after a four-decade war and Reach being the last human colony off Earth. What people ought to be constantly afraid of is a Covenant invasion, not a rebellion. I'm not even sure it's plausible that there is still a rebellion at this point.
No, it was confusing. It was confusing.
Yeah, but Bungie seems to be doing that a lot, like trying to create a mystery when there is no mystery. I mean, like with ODST, you had all these clues that you're supposed to find, but there was no mystery to solve. And here, you know, it's just, oh, you know, the communications relay went out. Go investigate, find out what it is. But it's not surprising to anybody.
Sure, there was a mystery. The mystery was, why does anybody think that a bent sniper rifle hanging on an electrical wire means anything? All right. Less is Moa, part one. Oh, yes, gave character archetypes, the Buck Dare story, and hints at the secret mission, all in about the same time that Reach's first cutscene takes to show us some mountains, Emil's knife, and some falcons. Is this a case of less is more or less is less?
It's
Blackstar.
Go ahead.
I don't know. Cody's obviously got something to say.
Oh, well, I was going to say, like, you know, for as much as I don't like ODST, I think that the opening was really good. And I think that that's an example of how you introduce characters and you do it right, because I think a lot of it is, you know, they're not telling us what to think. They're just showing us how they behave. I mean, you know, you like, I knew that Buck had a thing for Dare even before they went and they said that, just because of the way that he kind of looks at her and the way that the things he says. I mean, he calls her by her first name, that kind of stuff. I mean, that's really, really good. But in the beginning of Reach, you know, it's just talk to me, talk to me, talk to me, talk to me, you know?
Blackstar.
Well, let's see. I'm always a fan of Show Me, Don't Tell Me. And as far as how they wanted to pack in X amount of stuff within a short space of time, yeah, I can understand it. As far as Emil's knife goes, yeah, that gives you a little inkling. As far as the Buck backstory, it was a little, you know, soap opera, you know, as far as how much of an impact in the story. They wanted it to be an underlying thread of the interaction between these two characters as being a major point. So that one, I think, makes a little bit more sense because it's a defining element of not only both their characters, but also how they interact and how they actually react to different situations that the levels of the game present to you. As far as Emil and the Falcons and et cetera, it's more of like icing on the cake rather than any kind of substance or anything too deep. But yeah, as far as, you know, archetype characters, they all are to a certain extent. So I think that's, you know, something you could argue about all of them and their video game characters. But yeah, as far as the cutscenes and everything else, less can be more. The question is, what's the timing and how much relevance it has to what they're trying to present to you? So if there's something, some element that they can present to you visually without resorting to back text, without resorting to flashbacks, without resorting to horrible dialogue, I'm all for it. The question is, how effective is it? And is there a feeling towards the player whether or not what you just shown them is either too much or not enough? And that's a balancing act. So, and with every situation being different, yeah, you got to play with a little, and you're never going to make everybody exactly happy.
Okay, well, I think the resolution here is that this is the least impressive opening cinematic in Halo history. Okay.
What about Halo Wars?
Relay race. Halo Wars doesn't count.
Okay.
Or anything.
Next topic, relay race. Our first mission here is supposedly to recover or investigate the downed Visegrad relay, which makes us, at best, the delivery team for a repairman. Woo-hoo. Isn't headquarters right that deploying Spartans for this is a gross misallocation of resources? How can they be expecting rebels to attack what is supposed to be the headquarters of the UNSC military? Isn't it crawling with Spartans? And if it isn't, why is Noble Team here at all? Cody, does this make any sense whatsoever?
I don't know. Maybe Oni really knew that the Covenant were there all along, and this was all one big ruse. And I don't know. It's, yeah, you're right. It does.
So they sent those first non-Spartan troopers in as canaries in the mine.
You kind of, you kind of do have to stretch to make that work, to be honest.
Blackstar.
Do you know how long it is you have to wait for the cable repairman guy? I mean, come on. Now you're in the middle of a combat situation on Reach. You've got to fix that relay. Yeah, this is one of those things where they just give you something to do. It could be anything. And, well, okay, we'll make him go here and do this. It seems to me like they had 5 post-it notes on the board saying, okay, they've got to go here and do something. What should we pick? They threw a dart, and that was it. I don't really see this as being anything terribly relevant, and you're right. Any number of players or people or characters could have accomplished this very, very same task, but they had to put something on the board for you to do other than gratuitously blowing things away, and this is what they picked. So as far as it being any relevant or deep meaning, no, it's just, it's almost as a rail shooter stop off point.
Right, Blackstar is right. They chose this missing objective by throwing darts at a dartboard or to hide the fact from you that the real goal of this mission is to rescue a scientist's daughter from her virginity. Okay, super troopers. Some of the Spartans and Noble team wonder, where are the troopers? They find a burning warthog and a relay, and there's nobody around. Well, I'm reminded of previous sequences in other Bungie games where people wonder why there aren't any bodies, going back to Crow's Bridge in Myth, or the missing bodies in the second level of the first Halo game.
Which was much better.
There are no Thrall and no Flood in this game. If the Covenant wanted to attack the relay to get access to the scientists, why did they attack the troopers so far away from the relay? And having attacked them so far away from the relay, why did they drag the bodies with them back towards the relay, but not all the way? Again, does this make any sense, Blackstar?
No, there's a lot of elements. I mean, there are plot holes and things that you could drive a warthog through, and obviously either it wasn't deep enough for them to worry to get into as far as the specificity of any particular situation going on with this, or they simply thought that whatever explanation that they give to you is going to suck anyway, so it's like, hey, we're just going to tell them this, and they can just take it as read. And I think that's what they wanted to do with a lot of these elements, is they didn't really quite flesh out all the you know, problems or elements that interact with each other. They weren't working as clockwork. You know, they weren't set up in a way that you can't deny any of the variations or the options or the what if questions that people are going to present to this, because they figured, hey, no one's really going to care that much about it. And yet here we are, because there are certain people that do think about these things and want the relevant story to actually mesh together in a meaningful way, where whatever explanation or whatever suspension of disbelief that they give you as far as the story goes makes sense. This isn't one of them. So I think it was just something that they didn't think was that important.
It's just
hey, Cody.
Yeah, it's just sloppy writing, because you can tell that their intent was to start off with a little mystery. Why is this comma right down? And have the tension build until you find the Covenant. And I think that they thought that this was the only way to do it. You know, to create some kind of mystery to keep you guessing until it's revealed what you knew all along. I mean, that's really all it is. That's just Bungie trying to create tension where there really isn't a lot.
Okay, that, and I think they wanted to make a political comment about Abu Ghraib. next topic. Less is MOA, part 2. Bungie has gradually added back many of the features that have been on the Halo drawing board since the very beginning, but for one reason or other ended up being cut from the games. Covenant Engineers finally made it into ODST. The Flamethrower made it in for Halo 3. Dinosaurs that we first saw back in 2000 finally make their way back into Reach in 2010, but before that we get ostriches.
Woohoo!
Sure, whacking them is fun, but does this add or detract from Halo Reach's sense of planetary tragedy? Cody?
I think it adds to it, just because, you know, now it's not just some empty wilderness, but there's other life there. You know, it just makes it feel more like an actual place. I was actually quite pleased when I was playing through this level and then Sword Base, because I just thought about, you know, the 2000 E3 demo and, you know, the Macworld 99 demo. And it was like, wow, this is feeling like what Halo was meant to be. So for me, it definitely enhanced the experience.
Blackstar.
To be honest, I was a little bit disappointed with the dinosaur-esque creatures at the end and was much more captivated and interested in that original 1999 demo that they showed, where the military teams gets dropped off and you see them passing by, grazing on the side of a particular hill. That seemed immersive to me. This one didn't. The ostriches are interesting, but they're one creature. I remember the rats that they showed in Halo 2, and again, that was one other thing that they wanted to throw in a little cutesy bit to make it a little bit, you know, more natural or immersive. The rats were okay. The ostriches, yeah, not so much. And I don't know whether it's because they're just running around like idiots way too often or only in one level, or whether they didn't have enough other natural creatures in the different elements and areas you went to continue that level of immersion. It was one thing that it just feels like they threw that in the box because they could, not because it has any other relevant meaning. Same thing with the dinosaur bits, where you see these large creatures that you have to kill and you never see anything like them or similar to them or anything in relating to whatever you're doing beyond that. They're there to be shot at. That's it. And if you don't want to shoot at them, you go around. If you want to destroy them, you can. That's it. It's a minor blip that doesn't really add anything to it and just makes it feel more cheesy than anything else. The original creatures in the first video were cool because they were ambiance. This, it's like a speed bump you have to step over.
How are the Moas not ambiance?
It's just that they don't seem to serve any purpose other than to be there. They're obvious.
Now, isn't that what ambiance is? It's just like, oh, they're there just to be there and enhance the mood. I mean,
yeah, but see, the thing is when you saw the original dinosaurs grazing off to the side there, you didn't have to interact with them. They were garnished. They were a nice little side dish that made it look nice. These things are there for a blip. If you were crawling all over Halo and you ran across, there's a dinosaur over here, then you go over five of the hills and there's a different dinosaur over there, and you go over to another level, four levels down, there's a different type of creature over there. That's adding to the ambiance. That's giving you the immersive thing of being on an alien world. Here, you're on Reach, and you run into these two dinosaurs for one level, you shoot them both, and that's it. And the ostriches run around like idiots. And that's it. It's like the only two things on the entire planet that are different. There are no cats, no dogs, no horses, no chickens, no pigs. You know, there's no other elements of life other than those two things. And they're there for such a short period of time.
The answer here is that there are birds and there are fish. And the answer is that Moa burgers are tasty, especially with cheese. Okay. Invincible Farmers. We go from a frustrating and difficult escort mission in Halo 1, trying to protect an all-too-fragile, all-too-vulnerable Captain Keyes, to having invincible NPCs, to having invincible sidekicks, to having invincible farmers that are immune to bullets but can be killed by a melee strike that also instantly kills the player for having killed a civilian. When does gently guiding the player away from counterproductive behavior break verisimilitude? Why an insta-kill instead of the more traditional Halo method of having your own teammates turn on you? Blackstar.
It was stupid. It totally took me out of the game because one of the first things I did when this guy started yakking was I put a bullet into his head and nothing happened. And boom, instantly I knew I was playing a video game. Instantly I was out of the story. The immersion was gone. I mean, even in the original Halo game, when you started shooting armored Marines or if you shot Captain Keyes, there was a reaction to it instantly. There was a consequence for what you did. And here, there was nothing. You can whack him, but you can't shoot him. I'm sorry, that was a flat-out mistake. I don't know why it happened. I don't know if there's a technical excuse. But for me, it just absolutely ruined that whole scene and almost ruined the game for me, to tell you the truth. It really did. It really ticked me off.
Well, I mean, if you're going to have these scripted sequences like Bungie does, it's
make it
very,
a cutscene. Make it a cutscene.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's very hard to plan for all these contingencies. I mean, obviously, if the player kills, you know, one of the civilians that's interacting with Jorge, then that scene is something's going to happen to that scene. And it's really, really difficult to let the player do whatever they want and still have the story carry forward.
I have a gun and tons of bullets. I am going to shoot everything. That is the point that anyone who's making a video game is going to have to understand.
Well, I mean, if you look at a game like Deus Ex, it does it very well. I mean, you can basically kill like all of the main characters and the story can still flow around it. But I just don't think Bungie's that good at setting up a narrative like that. And that's the reason that this is happening, is because the narrative is taking priority.
Well, see, that doesn't make any sense to me either, because even in Halo 1, where there was a narrative that you had to do certain things, if you went up and you shot Captain Keyes in the head, guess what? He died. Cortana says, oh my God, he's gone rampant. Marines, take him down quick. And you were killed by invincible people. That didn't take me out of it. That didn't take me out of the game. My bullets didn't go through Keyes' head and nothing happened. Okay? And even other Marines, even if you went and killed other Marines, even if you shot them, you could wound them for a very long time before they actually got pissed and died. And it wasn't until after you killed two, three, or four of them till the Marines went after you. So even in that first game, you could go around blowing away people that you're not supposed to, and it didn't take you out of the game. And yet you were still able to continue the story.
I mean, you could do that because they didn't have scripted sequences that they had to perform. It didn't matter if they were alive or dead.
Right, but they could have done the exact same thing for this one here. But they didn't.
Well, then they couldn't have had
exactly
the,
do
they have had
armors
the sequence.
Do that's essential.
Yeah, exactly. Other than putting out that gratuitous amount of dialogue of the story that they wanted to tell you, which had absolutely no relevance whatsoever to anything else.
I think you answered your own question. I mean, they wanted the players to see that, and they didn't want there to be a way for the players to miss that.
Right. But I, as a player, want to miss that. I want that.
I know
option.
That Reach isn't trying to be an RPG at all, but this sequence reminded me of something similar in the beginning of the first Mass Effect game. You come across two characters that are also kind of locked inside this cargo container type thing, and where this sequence in Reach doesn't give you any choice other than to listen to these guys speak Hungarian and to get the tiny little exposition dump that something in the field killed his son.
Ooh.
Mass Effect not only gives you a dialogue tree that you can either rush through or you can explore at your leisure, but also gives you the option at the end of that of several different ways to dispose of those characters, including knocking them out, killing them, being nice to them, or several other things. But here you don't get any other option. The only thing I could think of is that the real answer is that all the Hungarian farmers of Reach are Spartan ones, and that's why they're immune to bullets. Okay, next topic, the Scourge of Skirmishers. Are these guys walking buggers, or are they gentle jackals? Are these jackal snipers made bearable, or just buggers in smaller groups? Cody?
Are you asking whether or not they're fun to fight? Is that what the question is?
Yes.
I like them. I thought they were good because it gives a vertical element to the game that, you know, ODST was lacking. You know, for once I have to actually look on top of roofs to, you know, find the enemy that's shooting at me. And I think it just gives a little more variety to the combat. I don't see anything wrong with them.
Okay. So you are firmly pro skirmisher.
Yeah. I mean, the way that they were used in the game, the way that they were designed and the way the level designers used them, I'm definitely pro skirmisher.
Okay, Blackstar.
I would have to agree. I'm very much a proponent of the skirmisher species over jackals in almost everything. There's got a point where those jackal shields are just so frustrating and annoying that, especially when you're in a position where you don't have any other particular weapons or ammunition to take them down in any meaningful or efficient way, that I find them far more enjoyable as a character in fighting. The only thing that of course they do that's terribly annoying is they seem to jump like Superman and everything. If they walked around and behaved just the way that the jackals did themselves, I think they would be perfect. As far as the bugger aspect, nothing is as bugging as buggers. The multiple aspects of having to worry about things above, behind, around, and flying through the air around you in circles all at the same time, given 12 targets, is far more annoying and disconcerting in combat than anything that skirmishers do. So, pro-skirmisher, absolutely.
Don't you know the trick to killing jackals with the shields? I mean, dude, just you shoot them in the hand, then they recoil and their shields fall away, then you shoot them in the head.
Yep.
Yeah, I'd say that's one of the most satisfying... That's one of the most satisfying combat sequences in all of Halo, is doing that over and over again.
Yeah, I find it annoying more than anything else, because one time or another, something either gets in the way, something doesn't work, you have the wrong gun, you don't have enough ammo, whatever. I just find, especially in playing multiplayer on occasion, is that if I have the option for eliminating any of the jackals with shields in my combat, I do it, simply because it's just not enjoyable. I've been doing it for 10 years, enough is enough.
Okay, verdict is that skirmishers win 3-0. Postscript on the mini skirmisher. I think you guys both know what I'm talking about here. When you walk into the first structure, you hear a character walking overhead. That turns out to be a tiny miniaturized skirmisher that's there just to make noise. And later on, when you hit a checkpoint, he grows larger and he becomes the skirmisher that you fight later on. It's possible to jump up on the building before that sequence, though, and get a look at him. Is seeing behind the curtain like that worth having Bungie strew the entire planet with kill zones and soft barriers, or should players be free to see whatever they want, whether what is there is fully textured or intended for player sight at all? Blackstar.
I find that the mini skirmisher would be on the same level as, if you remember back in Halo 1 in the 343 Guilty Spark levels, where you're going down and you first see the entrance to the underground elevator. You see the pistols and the rifles hanging in the air, shooting random shots as the Covenant are running away. Now, from the perspective when you first walk up on it, it looks like there is somebody fighting and shooting them and they're just running away. Well, if you sneak up over a ridge and go around the side, you can actually see the guns appear and disappear and fly and shoot bullets through the air. And it seems very disconcerting and makes no sense. This, I think, was just simply a technical way to achieve what they wanted to do that wasn't very difficult or ruining or breaking anything with the engine or the game. I thought it was cool. It's a neat little tidbit. It's you know, if you sneak around and get up on top of it, yeah, you can peek behind the curtain and say, oh, this is how they did it. It doesn't really take away from the game for me. As far as the kill zones and everything else, a lot of them were terribly annoying. And in fact, there were a couple places where a kill zone would have made sense where it didn't. There were a couple times I slid off rocks or somebody drove a warthog off the edge of a cliff in combat and I'm hanging off of a ledge and I can't move. I can't hit a kill box. I can't die. I can't throw myself off and I can't blow myself up. So now I'm stuck. And
revert to save, man.
Yeah. Well, that's just it. Having to do that, it just, you know, took you out of the element. It took you out of the game again. So as far as that goes, no, not a problem with the mini skirmisher. As far as kill zones, if you're going to do them, I would probably make sure that you're doing them in all the right places. But for the majority, I really wish that they didn't have them. I'm a big proponent of exploring and seeing all the other elements around the game where you normally wouldn't be able to go to. So no on the kill boxes.
Okay, Cody.
I mean, do you even have to ask my opinion about this? I mean, no.
Not really.
Yeah, I mean, no. I think it's one of the worst things that you can do as a developer to put kill barriers, to put invisible barriers, things that artificially limit the player, because you teach them the world that this game takes place in. You teach them the physics of the game. You teach them the abilities that you have. So when they put two and two together and the player decides, oh, you know what, I'm going to jump up on this ledge. And then suddenly they say, oh, wait, no, you can't do it. It doesn't work that way. Yep. That's not a good thing, because then all that stuff that you taught is meaningless in a sense.
Yeah, can I chime in again? And one thing you didn't mention in this one that I should I found terribly annoying is the time delay countdown for dying. The kill zones where they actually say...
Yeah, there's a lot of issues with that.
We'll save that for later.
Those I would agree with, Cody, are awful.
Okay, so the verdict here is that rampancy is too cool for kill barriers.
Yeah.
Now, the next topic. I don't see any training wheels. Despite 10 years of Halo games and a total of 5 FPS titles, Halo still eases the player into the game with tutorial elements, including a structured introduction to grenades. We get this in the level Syria 1117 in Halo 3, when the Arbiter points out a pile of grenades to the player, and here, where we spawn with no grenades at the beginning of the level, but we then get them in an area where we're intended to use them immediately. Is this an example of Bungie being sensitive and making the games approachable for new fans? Or is this just catering to casuals? Cody.
Well, I actually don't know, because I didn't experience that, because I played this on Heroic the first time, and on Heroic you get grenades because they assume that you know how it works. So on one hand, I guess I'm not that opposed to them doing that on lower difficulties when I really think about it. But at the same time, I don't think that's necessary. I think that if you have either a tutorial that you can select from the menu that is separate from the game, or you have an instruction manual to tell people how it works, then you can... It's just better, because if you integrate the tutorial into the game, then you have to go through that every single time you want to play, even if you know what
it's trying to teach you. But isn't it true that people don't read manuals, and that even if you put a tutorial accessible from the game, they would be a subset of people who need the tutorial but don't think they would and won't select it?
Well, people got by you know, before this became commonplace. I mean, if they're stuck and they can't figure out how to proceed, they're going to figure it out eventually, you know? I mean, I think the bigger problem is when, like I said, when you have the tutorial so integrated into the level design that when once you go through it a second time and you are an expert, that you have to, you know, you have to go through it again.
Blackstar.
I would say yes on both. Yes, they're doing it to make it more sensitive and approachable for people who have never picked up a controller and played a Halo game before. And yes, they're trying to cater to casuals who may be interested and want to try it out and make sure that it's not annoying. There is a massive jaded crowd out there that if they're not getting this in 5 minutes, they throw the controller away and they'll never play it again. Or they'll hate it and they'll get on blogs and internet and say, oh my god, that game sucked. And they're trying to defeat that. The real skill here is to try to incorporate those type of training elements in a way that's not so obvious. And I don't think that they've achieved that.
I disagree. That's the aim. I think you need to make it as obvious as possible and as separate as possible, because that way you don't waste anybody's time. If you need the tutorial, you select it from the menu and you do the tutorial. If you don't need it, then you jump right to the game and you jump right into playing. That to me is the ideal situation.
Okay, if I can continue.
Some of the people who need the tutorial the most are the ones who aren't going to admit they need it. And that's right. Why I'm generally pro integrated tutorial. Yes. I think Reach is the least intrusive of all the Halo's game. I just find their strange attention to grenades on normal a little bit weird.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Give them an achievement for completing the tutorial. Topic. I don't know.
Next topic. Free Fire Zone. Master Chief may have had a dry wit, but he never ever glorified in the violence he caused. Does it deepen or cheapen the Spartan mystique for Noble Team to have the range of character archetypes it does? And here I'm talking about Emil's remark.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
All of Reach is now a free fire zone. Blackstar. Hello.
Okay, all right. So you're saying if the general design and the established character that they had of the Master Chief is suddenly different, there's a Spartan out there that may not hold up to the same level of ideology or ideals that people had perceived about him before. Is that what you're saying? Right. Okay. I don't really think it was that big of a deal, to tell you the truth. I really don't think that they had thought about it that deeply, as far as that particular character goes. I think that the dialogue and the elements that they were trying to get across in the story, that would be relevant to his character. Not so much in any way, shape, or form reflecting on the whole Spartan program or as the established parameters for the hero archetype. I really don't think it was that important to anyone who was particularly interested in the story at all. And people who aren't interested in the story at all, they could care less what any of these characters say anyway.
Cody.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned Gears of War, because I think that for the aesthetic that they were trying to adopt for Reach, that was kind of the right choice, because, you know, I don't know if they actually looked at Gears of War and said, we want our game to be like that. But they definitely adopted the feel of it. They definitely adopted some of the themes. They, you know, adopted the visual style in a way, too. So it only makes sense to have a character who would be at home in the Gears of War universe when you're trying to make Halo more like Gears of War. So I don't know, kind of like Blackstar, I don't think it bugged me really too much, because, you know, for what it was, it fit right in.
So the verdict is all aboard the Coltrane.
Absolutely.
Okay, next topic, the Golden Compass. Halo has long had waypoints to point out objectives to the player, and some levels even had arrows on the floor. Once past the first encounter of Reach, there are a few basic choices of where to go and what to do next. None of them are wrong, and you're often only given a vague direction, like east or northeast of your position, to suggest where it is that you should go next. Are navigation and exploration part of the Halo experience for you, or do you just want a clear path to follow so you can blow some more stuff up? Cody.
No, I like what they did. I mean, it reminded me of Halo, the level Halo, where, you know, you have this goal, but it's kind of up to you to figure out how to approach it, you know, whom to rescue first, whom to rescue second. So I enjoyed that very much. I like having that option to pick my battles and approach whichever battle I want. But I don't want it to be, I think you can go too far with that. You know, I mean, if your game is just too open, obviously you're not going to know what to do, and it's going to have no structure. But this didn't bother me. I actually quite enjoyed it. So I'm going to give that the thumbs up.
Okay, Blackstar.
I would probably have to say, and maybe skipping ahead a little bit, but my answer to that is Silent Cartographer. I didn't think that there were enough levels in any of the later games like Silent Cartographer, where it almost seemed like its own little element within everything else, but you still could approach it in so many different ways that you could play that same level and never do the same thing twice. And there were too many times in the later Halo games where you felt like you were on rails, where everything was linear. And while there were a couple elements we could go a little bit left and a little bit right, or a little bit up or a little bit down, you were never approaching or going to any of the major elements and had the same kind of freedom of movement that you did in either that level or any of the other larger levels within, say Halo 1, and even to some extent a couple in Halo 2. It felt more like being on the bridge in Halo 2, where you were going straight the whole time. And whether there's a navigation point there or not, you still had a sense or felt like there was more freedom of movement and range of order on what goals that you were going to achieve next and how you would achieve those goals. So I'd have to say that these ones are a little bit more lacking than the earlier ones.
I kind of have to disagree about that, because, you know, linear level design is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, one of my favorite levels in the entire Halo series is Cairo Station, and that's about as linear as it gets. Because when you have a linear level, what you can do is, as a designer, you can actually pace the encounters, you know? Whereas if on Halo, you can't really do that, because it's up to the player where to go and when to go. So it doesn't bother me when the Bungie's later Halo games do that, as long as they do it well and they do it for a purpose. Did I like Silent Cartographer? Yes. Did I like what they did on, you know, on Sword Base and on Winter Contingency? Yes. You know, you need a mix of both.
I hated the level you just mentioned there, the Cairo Station one.
Oh my gosh.
I thought it was terrible.
Okay. Well, I think the verdict here is that it's not bad to let the player do a little exploration and to choose what encounters to go to first. However, I do think I have to point out that the circular geography trick that Silent Cartographer plays and that they repeat in Sword Base and Winter Contingency works best when you're on an island. It makes sense on Silent Cartographer that there are essentially three choices. You go around the island one way, you can go around the island the other way, or you can go up through the middle of the island. When the geography is different, when you don't have that surrounding water, then restricting the player's movement to just one direction or the other along a circular path seems to make less sense. Next topic, keep on trucking. Reach gives us a civilian vehicle that is unarmed that you can drive while George jumps on the back with his lag turret, essentially make it into an equivalent of a warthog. Is there any point in making what is only a cosmetic difference between this vehicle and a well-known gameplay element, the Warthog? Cody?
Yeah, there's a difference, because it makes you feel like you're just trying to scrape by. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, the Covenant just attacked. What are we going to do? Oh yeah, let's just turn this truck into a makeshift Warthog, you know? That's all I got.
Okay, Blackstar.
No, I think it goes to the environment that you're in. You're not in a military base. You're not in an environment where, you know, everybody and their cousin has a military vehicle hanging around. These are civilians doing civilian things. It made more sense if they had different types of trucks. And unfortunately, they just have one. Same thing with the bulldozers. They just have one. And it was there because of what the environment that you were in, as opposed to being there for you as a military support vehicle or required for a particular task. It was an environmental piece.
Okay, so the answer is that the trucks, like the MOAs, add to ambiance and verisimilitude.
Yes.
Okay, we're going to come back a little bit to the geography question in the illusion of choice. Like Starlight Cartographer, where you can go around either way on the island without hitting any barriers, or like Halo, where you can choose to rescue groups of Marine in any order you like, there's a bit of non-linearity here. Some encounters you can skip, and there are two that you can do in any order you like. But are the choices here real, or are they fake? If they're fake, are they worth making? And if they're real, do they have real consequences? How hard would it be to have them have real consequences? And I'm thinking here of Halo, where you have three opportunities to save groups of Marines, but you can succeed or fail at this task without affecting the progression of the game. The only consequence is psychological, by telling you that you failed. Blackstar, what do you think? Could they or should they have added a similar element to these missions here?
I wish that they had had an element or designed it in a way that the consequences that you did either led you in different paths or led the order of the paths changed, or to have real consequences in how the game unfolds. That feels far more immersive, and it feels like what you do matters. Whereas the other way, it doesn't. They simply make you feel bad, assuming that you care. And again, there are people that will and the people that won't. So it's only going to be affecting a majority of the people who are playing this. So as far as that goes, I had thought in my head over the number of years in between Halo games of different ways that they might do it. It might be interesting. And in other Halo games where you bounced around between different characters, in the original Halo 1, they changed things up by making you go the same levels in a different order at night as opposed to during the day. It changed things slightly, but it did make it interesting enough. In Halo 2, you got a chance to play as a different character from a totally different perspective. That's nice, but again, it would have been better if they had overlapped them more, where you could play through the entire game as the Master Chief, and then if you wanted to, you could play through the entire game as the Arbiter. But they didn't. They halved it. They did it half this way and half the other way. So that was kind of disappointing. In this one, yeah, you can make a couple choices and do a couple different decision-making things, but as far as it having any kind of major impact, I don't think it does either way.
Okay, Cody.
Well, I mean, this is a pretty complex issue. I mean, basically, unless you're playing an actual RPG, something like Dungeons and Dragons, then, I mean, your choices aren't going to matter in the scheme of things anyway, in terms of the narrative, because you still have a narrative that you have to follow, and, you know, they have to program that onto the disc. You know, you don't have a dungeon master who can change the narrative based on your choices. So really, the best you're going to get with a video game is just a series of branching paths. And that's not very interesting, because then you can just go back and say, like, oh, I didn't save them this time. I'm just going to replay that level, and then I'm going to save them to see what happens. Like, those choices aren't significant. And you can't really get significant choices unless you have a human directing the story. Do you see what I'm saying? So I think that worrying about whether or not these choices are real or fake is sort of... it's sort of a waste, really. And I think you just have to think about whether the choices are interesting or not in terms of challenge.
Okay, so I think the verdict here is that Spartans do dream of electric sheep. I'm going to skip the next topic here because I think we've already debunked the myth of the insurrection. Let's jump to the next one after that, which is the flesh is willing. And what can be interpreted as a nod to some of the continuity inconsistencies inherent with trying to change a game's armory over time, Reach as a prequel to Halo 1 brings back the tuning fork-shaped Spirit dropship. Sure, they're iconic, but they don't really fit the organic look that most other Covenant vehicles, especially Elite vehicles, have. And the design never really made much sense anyway. Does bringing the Spirit back unify this final installment with the first game, or is it just runaway nostalgia? Cody?
It's a good question. I'm going to have to say,
That after an hour, we reached a good question.
Yeah, you know, it's nostalgia, really. I mean, that's all it is. It's not like these ships are, well, actually, no, they are functionally different, because one of the fun things to do in the original Halo was to, like, stick elites with plasma grenades right as the sides were opening, so you could kill them right as they were coming out.
Right, which just shows you how bad and ridiculous a design this is for a dropship.
Yeah, but at the same time, it was fun. So in that sense, I'm glad that it came back, but, you know, in Reach, the physics are significantly different. You're a lot weaker, so it's much, much harder to do that, because they, you know, they've got, like, nuclear powered turrets on that thing this time. so you can't really do that anymore, but, yeah, it's fun. I don't see the harm in putting it in there.
Personally, I never
Blackstar.
Really... yeah, personally, I never really understood the design anyway. I mean, even when you saw in Halo 1 when Captain Keyes and everyone were escaping by piloting one of these things out of Truth and Reconciliation, I was sitting there wondering the whole time. I was like, okay, this is where the people deploy out of it. This is the gun turn. And these are supposedly the engines and the mechanics and everything. Where is everybody else going to fit? when you think about how character, how big these characters actually are. So the design of the ship itself is not the greatest in the world. And yeah, I think putting it in there, they simply put it in there to get all the Naglers to be quiet, saying it's like, oh, no, no, you didn't have those things back in Halo 1, and this one's before that one, so we have to have it here. So I think, yeah, it's an element of nostalgia and continuity. I think they put it in. Yeah, it's cool. They hadn't seen them in a while. Let's throw them in there. And then all the people complaining about how come we didn't have them in the game, we can shut them up.
Okay, well, the answer is that the tuning fork-shaped Spirit dropship helps Halo hit perfect pitch. They're a good inclusion, even if they are not just nostalgia. Next topic, and I think that'll be the last part of this level that we do before next.
Can I add a topic to this level, though? I have another topic that's related to the level that we might want to talk about, if I can bring it up after this.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we can do that. A Farewell to Arms. Our second flight in a Falcon gives us a little bit taste of the rail shooter goodness that is to come later. But for now, we're just along for the ride. Not only don't we get a turret, but we can't even fire out the window with the weapons we do have. Not at the Covenant, and certainly not at our Spartan seatmates. Is sensibility spoiling the fun of Halo? Doesn't everybody spend a few missions just chucking plasma grenades at Pelican passengers? Blackstar.
Well, I was never a fan of being dragged along through this any vehicles for any length of time, really, to tell you the truth. In fact, when there are other moments where you're flying with the Falcons, first either by piloting or by gunning, I absolutely love that grenade launcher in that thing. In fact, I really wish that that section where you're flying inside the Falcon with either yourself, just yourself or your partner, where you're lobbing grenades at this big, huge combat area, I wish we had done that more often, because that's one of the only times you feel like you're actually effectively doing anything in the game, where you actually have the firepower necessary to defeat the enemies that you're seeing. But yeah, as far as you know, whether or not it's rail shooter goodness is good or bad, it has its place. It has its moments. But yeah, I don't know. Whether it's defeating the fun of actually just hanging around and goofing off, I think it just slows your chances or limits the opportunities that you have for doing that. But yeah, not shooting, I don't know whether it was that big of a deal either way. But yeah, it just means that there's one more element one more section where you can't do that.
Hey, Cody.
I don't like the rail sections in Reach, you know, simply because they are less complex than the game itself. I mean, because in the game, you not only have to aim and shoot your weapon, but you need to move and jump and duck and cover and all that. Whereas on the rail section, it totally eliminates that element of character movement. So basically, it's just a simplified version of the game. And that's, you know, that's not interesting to me. Yeah, the fact that you just have to sit in the Falcon and ride along, that's kind of what spurred me to figure out how to steal the Falcon and get it past the barrier, which is a lot of fun, taking that over into the last section of the level and killing all the grunts and all the jackals and elites out of your invincible Falcon. Everybody should try that sometime.
Ah, see, there you go. That's one undesigned element that is incredibly fun. Basically, with the rail shooter aspect of it, yeah, I can understand Cody's disdain for it because he likes control to it. But if you think about it, there are tons of sections that are equivalent to rail shooters all throughout Halo, where you are at the total control of an AI pilot, whether it's somebody driving a Warthog or somebody driving a tank or any other vehicle. This is just an extension of that, I think. And getting a chance where you have to rely on the pilot not getting you killed, they've simplified that by it not being a factor with these rail shooter sections, is basically.
Well, where in any of the first games do you have to do any of that? Like, usually,
if you let somebody else drive the Warthog where you want a gun, you are totally at the will of him doing something stupid and dying. With the rail shooter sections, they've set it up so that the pilot is not going to kill you. The only thing you have to worry about is other thing of not defeating something that could kill you, either through shooting through the window or anything else. So they're taking out that idiot element. That's how I see those sections at. So yeah, they're rail shooter-ish. Yeah, they have their sections. They have their purpose. But it's not that often or that long in the game where it's detracting from it, I don't think. It's like, now I'm in a vehicle, I don't have to worry about the pilot driving his Warthog into a wall and not doing anything.
That's Max's.
Although you might have to worry about Banshee debris grounding your Falcon and breaking the entire mission. I saw that. Okay, Cody, you said you had a new topic you wanted to add.
What do you guys think about all the storytelling techniques that they use? Because they basically go through them all here in just the first mission. You have a cutscene to introduce it. You have the Half-Life style scripted sequences in the middle, and then you have something weird that's in between at the end. You have the first person segments, but you can't control them. So it's like a hybrid between the two. I mean, I was just wondering how you guys felt about that, whether or not any of those were effective.
I think the backstory on the Insurrection wasn't deep enough.
Yeah, I think it's hard to judge the effectiveness of each of the storytelling techniques without a compelling story.
They
bring out all the tools. They do polish all the tools that they've used, including those little non-controllable first-person sequences that I think we saw first in ODST. I don't think there are any of those in Halo 3.
Yeah, there were a couple like at the beginning on ODST.
Yeah, but the problem here is that Reach's story is compelling only in a surface way, and I think we'll end up talking about this a lot later. Certainly, you know, what happens to the planet and its population and what that leads to is all very important, but I'm not really sure the impact of that ever really comes through, despite all these techniques that Bungie tries to use.
I mean, I can comment on, you know, the first-person segment at the end. I thought it was totally ridiculous because, you know, you end up just standing there with your gun drawn at this elite and you can't shoot it. And you're just wondering, like, why don't these guys just lay into this elite? Like, what can I do? And the fact that it stays in first person just sort of gives it a staleness where nothing's happening. I mean, if they made that into a cutscene, you could make it a little more dramatic. You know what I mean? I didn't like that, the way that they did that.
Yeah, my notes didn't because I fell asleep last night trying to do this playthrough. To make these notes, I didn't get as far as the encounter with the elite inside the relay.
Okay.
So we can maybe go into more detail about that later. But I would say I don't know if Bungie ever formulated it as a rule. But looking at all the earlier games, you could see that what Bungie never ever did was to have a cutscene that included action that would normally be part of gameplay. In other words, they never use cutscenes to show you something that the player should have been playing. But then in Reach, that cutscene does exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
The question is why? Was it a conscious decision, or was it because they had to for whatever reason?
Yeah, and it's not even a cutscene. It's like a hybrid cutscene scripted sequence, you know? It's like they want to do the Half-Life thing, but they don't want you to look around, you know?
It's a quick time event.
I think they wanted to have an impressive intro for the elite, although that's not the first elite you see on the level. But I think they wanted to give you a chance to see that model up close,
right,
being menacing. And for that, it needed to be an action sequence, which normally they don't put action sequences into their cutscenes.
But then when you think about it, it's like that elite and even that other elite that you have to chase down later on in the game on Last Night of Solace. That's not even important.
To be honest, there are tons of elements where you were playing around in Reach where nothing that you did really seemed that important, which I find kind of shocking and annoying, because you would think that this group of people would have been at the forefront of the most important elements and missions necessary for the survival of the species, and they don't really do that much. There are a couple, but that's it, and certainly not as many as you'd think they would have.
Would you like to contribute to HaloReachIsNotCanon.net?
Well, you know, I'd hate to go against the fantastic story fans out there, such as myself. But yeah, no, there were a bunch of different things that they could have done but didn't, or I thought they should have had and they didn't. And that particular scene, though, I think it had more to do with the fact that the character movements were required to be out of game for it to even seem effective or real. I think it was also one of those moments where it's, you know, it's jumping at you and suddenly now it's in your face. So yeah, it was kind of almost like a shock, you know, jump out of the dark thing, more than anything else. But yeah, I don't think they could have incorporated that into gameplay very much. So you had two choices, either cutscene or the scripted action. They went with scripted.
Okay, well, I think we're going to pick up with the campaign in the next episode. We'll polish off this level and get into the next one. But before that, we want to cover another issue, which is related to the mechanics of somehow how Halo Reach's reward systems work. This is casual investment or hardcore divestment. Reach's system replaces Halo 3's experience with credits that are redeemable for cosmetic player customization features and rewards you for all kinds of play, solo or multiplayer, regardless of skill level or performance. You get a bonus just for completing a game. Is this a good way to draw in the less skilled players, or is this ruining the game by rewarding idlers, griefers, and those without the talent to play well or the sense to practice in order to improve their skills? Cody.
This is a big topic. I guess if I had to just say really quickly what I think about it, I think that it just shows it shows a lack of respect to the player, you know, because what the credits are essentially saying is that just playing the game alone isn't going to be enough. That's not going to be fun. You need this additional incentive to play, and with it you can get these cosmetic changes. And that's kind of disrespectful, because now suddenly they are manipulating you psychologically to play, as opposed to you just playing because you want to play. I mean, that's basically how I feel about the system. And it's kind of funny, because I guess when you really look at it, Reach's player investment system is really, really minor. You know, it doesn't hold a candle to something like World of Warcraft or like a JRPG, you know, but there's been a lot of negative reaction towards it. And I think it's just because it's sort of going down that step where your time as a player isn't being respected anymore.
Blackstar.
I think they're monetizing score whores, I think is what they're doing. They're saying, okay, if you want to have the special pimp hat for your helmet, you got to be doing X amount of blah, 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 blah. And I don't see the point. I've never been into Halo Dress Up Barbie. I don't really care what my helmet or my shoulder pads or my knee pads or my crotch plate look like. So for me, it's absolutely pointless. As far as the credit thing, the experience points and everything else, is they're now adding a numerical quantification of your time spent on this. And they're saying, okay, for you to get X amount in this that we want to offer you, you've got to put up this into it. And if you're not up to the task, or if you're not, you know, triple backflipping, three brutes and jumping over spirits and landing face first on hunters, oh, well, you're not getting it. And to me, that seems to artificially pushing up the bar. And I think that's basically the point that Cody's trying to make, is that playing the game's not fun enough. You've got to play it our way.
And it's not respecting the time of the player, because they're saying if you want this, you have to put in X amount of time.
Yeah. I don't want to play it your way. I want to play it my way. And if my way conflicts with yours, well, guess what? You're not going to be getting it the way that you want. I puffed up the money for this. I'm going to be doing to what I enjoy. And whether it's exploring strange levels you don't want me to see, or breaking, vehicles and doing things and putting them where they're not supposed to go, or whether it's taking the game incredibly slow and methodical the way that they had designed it for ODST, where you're creeping around every corner in the dark, that's the way I'm going to play. And if they're saying, oh, I've got to speed run this section and I've got to make it in 1 minute and 2 seconds, or I don't get the pink pimp helmet, no, forget it. That's not me. That's forcing me to play a specific way and to do a certain things and to get a certain number count off of whatever fake achievements that they come up with. And like Cody says, it's artificial and it's fake. And to me, it takes away from the immersion of the story and actually playing the game. I'm buying this to enjoy the game for what it is. And if I want to do all that, fine. Okay, give it to the option for the people who care. But give me the option to turn it off and to not shivig it afterwards either.
Well, what's interesting too is, you know, as mentioned in the question about the idlers and the griefers, it's like when you look at Halo 3's experience system, it's almost the opposite of what you see in Reach, because experience was kind of something that you didn't want to get, you know, because everybody got made fun of if they had a, you know, three bars under their rank. That means that, like, oh, you've been playing a lot and you haven't been ranking up. So there was almost a stigma with racking up experience points in Halo 3, unless you were a general, obviously. But in Reach, obviously everybody wants the credits because they want to get, you know, all these rewards. And I actually find it fascinating that people would enter a game and just not play, would just go make a sandwich or whatever just so they could come back and get the credits. I mean,
right. That's sad. That's pathetic.
Yeah, because that sort of exemplifies what I'm trying to say, is that the game is no longer fun, but this reward system is still compelling them to play.
Yeah. Or paying people to play. I mean, I've heard stories where people are hiring other people to play their characters.
Oh, sure.
To get their experience points up. Or taking loopholes in the system to keep logging in characters and breaking games and going it over and over and over again to get their fake ranks, their fake number scores up. It's sad. It's pathetic. And those are just rancors.
Well, also it's affecting everybody else's experience, because if you get it, if you jump into firefight and, you know, all your teammates are just there to get the credits and they're not trying and they're going idle or all that, then your experience is being impacted as well.
Yeah,
so
pathetic.
It's very interesting how I am actually quite surprised at the backlash against the player investment system. I mean, I'm totally against them on principle, but I didn't think that there would be as much negative feedback as there has been on the forums.
I actually remember, if I can interject here for a second, I actually remember an experience I had in a Halo 2 multiplayer game once, and this was back when Halo 2 first came out. I can remember people that we were playing against were screaming at the top of their lungs at me and my friends that we were playing with them were all cheaters, because all of us were level 16 or higher. And these people were all level 14, and they said, oh, these are all cheaters. Quick, report them all. They're cheating. And we were like, wait a minute, what are you talking about? It's like, nobody can get to level 16. You can't get up to level 60 without cheating. You must be cheaters. We're reporting you. And we were like, wait a minute. So you think nobody else can be better than a level 14 that you're at now in the game? And if they are, that automatically means that they're cheaters. And they believe that wholeheartedly, because their experience of anyone else beyond that level were cheaters and were jerks and were only doing this to get higher rank wars. And what are the ranks
think,
up to now?
I think they 50s? Were. I think they were trolling you.
No. I'm dead serious. They absolutely believed it. And we were surprised and shocked about it. But once you start putting a numerical value on stuff, the moment you start putting ranks on things, everybody's got to have the bigger e-penis than everybody else. And whatever they've got to do to get it, they will, because they don't want anyone else looking at them as being a lower ranked or a lower score than the next guy. It's all ego.
I don't quite agree when it comes to ranking based on skill, which is something that Reach does very differently than Halo 3. But, you know, if you have a game that's skill-based, you need some way to compare yourself to other people, or else
you don't.
How do you know if you're improving, you know? So, you know, I'm not against having, like, a rank that reflects your score. And if people try to cheat to get a higher rank, well, they really are cheating themselves, because then they don't have the skill to reflect that rank. But if you cheat to get credits, that's actually beneficial, because then you don't have to waste your time.
That's the thing, and that's the monetary aspect of it. It's one thing for bragging rights or to get in certain ranked games or whatever. But now you're adding into getting a chance to use all the extras that Bungie offers to it, and there's some benefit for those people who care about those things. I don't really care about any of the bonus packs or extra helmets or colored coordinating stuff or whatever. I don't play Halo, get Halo to play dress up, so none of that matters to me. But there are people that do. And for that, yeah, it's low, and it's ruining it for all the players that do happen to care about this stuff.
And I suppose to answer the last part of the question about, you know, whether or not it's beneficial to those who are not good at the game, I don't think it really is, because if they're able to keep doing what they're doing and seeing that credit bar move, they don't really have an incentive to improve their game or approach things differently. I mean, if it were purely rank-based, you know, they'd reach a point and they'd say, I have to up my game, I have to change the way I'm playing if I want to get a higher rank. And that's good, because then, you know, obviously they'll learn how to play the game differently, they'll have more fun when they get better, etc. But when you just have a progress bar that goes up, regardless of how you do in the game, I mean, just for joining the game and finishing the game, you get credits, I think it sort of encourages people to stagnate.
right. Well, I'll admit that while the system is open to abuse, it is quite obviously the future of the Halo franchise, and we will see that later this year when 343 Industries introduces Haloville for Xbox Live Arcade and Facebook.
Oh, I hope not.
Say thanks, everybody, for listening. We're going to pick up with the Reach campaign in the next episode, as well as some other issues, so thanks for listening.
Everybody go to HaloReachIsNotCanon.net and leave us a message on the forums.
Shameless plug.